Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruryak. The world now knows about Alex Honnold. He's the rock climber from Sacramento who trained at the Granite Arch Gym and sometimes still climbs indoors at Pipeworks. He's featured in that intense, terrific, Oscar-winning National Geographic documentary, Free Solo. It follows Alex as he becomes the first and so far only person to free solo El Capitan. Last year, Alex and Tommy Caldwell set a speed record climbing the nose in Yosemite in under 2 hours. Alex Honnold came to the Insight Studio in 2016. We talked about his life, which is traced in his memoir, Alone on the Wall, and about free solo climbing.
Free solo climbing just means climbing without a rope, without protection, just by yourself up on a wall. But just to be clear, free soloing makes up a very small percentage of my overall climbing. I mean, the majority of my climbing is with partners, with ropes, it's social, it's fun. It's totally normal climbing. It's just the occasional thing that I do free solo.
There had to have been a moment, though, out on a big wall or a rock somewhere when you decided, I want to take this on in a bigger way without the rope.
So I grew up climbing in the gym here in Sacramento, and so I was like pretty deeply immersed in climbing culture for my whole childhood. And there's like a whole generation of past soloists before me, and so there were a bunch of people that I found super inspiring as I grew up, and I just always sort of thought that I wanted to try that. And then as I started climbing outside more, I started dabbling in the soloing. I started on things that were 80 to 100 feet, and that feels pretty big when you're first starting. You're like, oh my gosh, that's so tall. But then eventually you sort of build up to like proper big walls.
That childhood gym, Granite Arch, is still open today. And that was a big deal when competitive climbing, especially for youngsters like you were maybe, what, 10 years old?
Yeah, I was maybe 10 or 11 when I started climbing regularly.
It was very exciting, a new sport. Were you outdoor climbing at the same time?
I did climb outdoors a tiny bit when I was a kid, but it was sort of, you know, on Easter vacation or whatever, go out or spring break, go climb for a few days or, you know, go with some friends for a couple days, basically a few days a year, probably. It wasn't until I dropped out of university that I started like climbing outside full time.
All right. We'll get to that point in a moment. Yeah. Meanwhile, I want to linger on this quote from your mom that I've heard, that you were really a terror when you were young, that you were climbing everywhere. And she was really happy to have you have a place to go to continue to do it and learn technique.
I mean, the rest of my family says that I was a total angel. I was well-behaved and great. I think I just climbed too much.
I just meant that some kids have that natural desire to be up or climb.
Yeah, no,
or
for
move.
Sure, I always wanted to climb on things. And I still, like, if I'm not rock climbing much, then it's fun to, like, play on a swing set or get on top of a building or just play around. I mean, it's all sort of playing.
You were an amazing student. Was this correct that your GPA was 4.7 when you graduated?
Something like that.
What came easily?
I feel weird saying it, but in school, like, most things came easily. I mean, school is just always relatively easy. Like, standardized tests are just easy because the answers are all laid out there for you. I don't know, but I just wasn't super passionate about it, which is why I ultimately dropped out of university.
High school, how much were you climbing and competing?
I think I was probably climbing, you know, 4 or 5 days a week. And I was bicycling to the gym quite a bit and then occasionally going with my dad. But then as I got older, I'd go more by myself.
Was there a point that your parents got nervous about the danger level increasing in your climbs?
My parents really knew about my climbing as I was going to the gym all the time, so there's no danger at all. It's totally safe. It's totally controlled. It's fun. When I started climbing outside more, my father died when I was 19, so he unfortunately didn't get to see the whole transition to real rock climbing, which is too bad because he spent so many hours belaying me in the gym. It's unfortunate he never got to see it like turn into becoming a professional climber. And then my mom didn't really know that much about climbing at the time anyway, so as I climbed outside more, it was just like, oh, yeah, he's going rock climbing, like whatever that means.
For people who haven't been in a gym, will you describe the material down at the bottom so that if you fall, you have a landing that is safe and easy to get up from?
Well, nowadays it's just like big, thick foam pads, like gymnastics pads, basically. Though back when I was a little kid, it was shredded tires.
That's
and, like,
what
shredded
I remember.
Rubber and Granite Arch. Yeah, it's pretty classic. And that actually does work really well, and that is quite safe. Now it's all about the like big, thick foam pads. And some gyms had like peat gravel. Like they had all kinds of different things, but anything that you could land on softly.
So you did go off to UC Berkeley. You were going to major in engineering. How long did it take to figure out that that's not what you wanted to do?
I think my whole Berkeley experiment just like was ill-fated from the beginning. I was living off campus, like in a family friend's place, but so I was kind of by myself. I didn't have any friends. I wasn't that excited about what I was studying. I just kind of hated everything about it. So I went to classes for one semester, and then the second semester I was still enrolled, but I was like basically just climbing, and then I just never went back.
Is the nature of being a climber some aloneness? A desire to be alone?
I don't know if climbing fundamentally requires aloneness. I mean, definitely the free soloing that I'm doing has a big emphasis on, you know, the solitary. But I think you could be a climber and only climb with your friends. I mean, if you're roped up, you always have a partner. And for the most part, I mean, the social aspect of climbing is like one of my favorite parts. But then the soloing is just, you know, occasionally you just have those extra adventures on the side.
Something in college decided it, though. You were in a competition and you finished second, and that was pivotal.
I got second in nationals when I was 19. I guess it was my last year that I was able to compete in the youth competitions. And so I was invited to Youth World Cup or whatever in Scotland. But it happened to be during the fall semester. So I was like, oh, I'll just take the semester off, go do this competition, climb in Europe a little bit. And then I just like never went back. But like I said, my father had also died the summer before. You know, it wasn't like pressure to go to college, but, you know, my parents both expected that I would go to college. It's just everybody goes to college. And so after he died, it was like a little bit less of that. And then I had this opportunity to take a semester off. And then I just, you know, now I've taken the next 12 semesters off, or no, like 20 semesters at this point, something like that.
Let's talk through some of the climbing adventures you've had. And we'll go back to the documentary. And first of all, the historic free solo climb, Moonlight Buttress in Zion National Park in Utah. Describe some of the statistics about this climb.
Well, so it's like a 1,000-foot pillar of sandstone. It's quite hard. I mean, the ratings don't really mean anything to the average person. It basically envision a 1-inch crack that just splits this entire buttress for 1,000 feet.
Perfect. Here's more of what you said about it in the documentary.
Moonlight was like 700 feet of continuous splitter finger crack. Just like a 1-inch fissures up a straight blank wall. Basically, you just put your fingers straight into the crack and just turn them a little to the side and they just wedge in there. Finger locking feels very exposed. You only have like a tiny amount of skin inside the crack, you know, like half of two fingers. And your toes are just pasted against the wall. So little of your body is actually touching the rock, and then it's just all air around you.
You have the biggest smile on your face right now.
Yeah, I do love Moonlight. And I love that kind of style. I love crack climbing like that.
You don't have long, thin fingers that might imagine would work really well reaching into the cracks in the rock. I guess you have the hands you have, so you make them work.
Yeah, I think all climbers, you know, you have the hands you have and you just make do with what you have. Actually, so I have fairly fat fingers, like, and that's
I wasn't going to say that.
Well, I understand, you know, I appreciate that. But no, I have pretty fat fingers. And so for something like Moonlight, that actually makes it feel easier because a 1-inch crack feels too baggy for somebody with skinny fingers. And then it's really, really hard to climb.
Oh.
But for somebody like me with fat fingers, it actually feels really secure.
Oh,
so, I mean,
love...
it's kind of all size dependent. Like all of climbing sort of depends on that kind of stuff.
All right. So some climbs are going to be more exactly suited to your body.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And Moonlight, when I did it, it was like, oh, you know, kind of groundbreaking, kind of like extreme. But for me, it always felt quite easy and pretty secure, partially because I have fat fingers and that's just a style that really suits me.
You became the first person to accomplish that climb in just a few hours?
Yeah, an hour 20, I think.
Oh, that's not even a few.
Well, it's, you know, it's close.
That wasn't where you stopped, because that next challenge then was the Northwest Face when you went into Yosemite free climbing Half Dome. And that was a peak that I think no one else had even tried to climb.
It'd been climbed, and I'd climbed it several times, but nobody had free soloed it before.
Ah, that's the difference.
Yeah.
Okay, so you work on the brain focus as much as your physical body and being able to know the route.
For free soloing, I mean, that's probably the most important thing, keeping your mind together.
Do you have a go-to place or a thought, a mantra, something that always keeps your focus?
No, not really. It's nice to think that, you know, like, I just have a happy place I go to and it centers me, but it's not really like that. It's more just that I just stay focused on what I'm doing, and that's all there is to it.
It seems that your brain, too, is constantly calculating and playing with scenarios.
Well, ideally, there's not that much of that going on. Ideally, you've rehearsed the route a little bit beforehand, and you know exactly what you need to do, so then there isn't that much second-guessing going on in the background. Because it's funny, when we talk about, like, climbing a 1,000-foot wall, what that actually comes down to move by move is, like, hundreds or thousands of discrete body movements where you subtly shift your weight a little bit left or right on your hips, you adjust your footholds, you like grab holds in very precise ways. And so it's actually quite a bit of intricate movement going on. And so to be able to remember all that movement and execute it in the right order and everything, I mean, that's the nuts and bolts of soloing.
I know you know when the world was watching as Tommy Caldwell and Kevin Jorgeson did El Capitan's Dawn Wall in 2015. I think it was maybe global education for a lot of people about climbing.
For sure.
But that's very different from what you're doing.
It's different than free soloing for sure, because they were roped up and they spent 19 days supported. But I mean, the principles are the same. I mean, they're still climbing the wall. They're using their hands and their feet. They just happen to have protection and, you know, they're camping on the wall and everything. Tommy's a really good friend of mine, and I mean, I was equally inspired by all that, and I think it was, I mean, it's an amazing climb.
Well, I think they would say that in 2012, when you achieved the triple solo, you put yourself in a place that no one else is in the world, and that means you climbed the three largest faces in Yosemite in less than 24 hours?
Yeah, correct. So this is interesting, because a week or two before that, I had free climbed the, free climb meaning climb with my hands and feet, but not free soloing. But so Tommy and I together had free climbed the triple in Yosemite.
Oh.
And that actually took us longer. When I soloed it, it took less time. And so when I did the solo link up, it wasn't free solo either. I wasn't free climbing. I was pulling on bolts. I was like cheating a little bit. I was using a rope here and there to assist me. So I was climbing by myself, which is soloing, but I was also like cheating a little. It wasn't technically free climbing, which is a really subtle distinction. And like for non-climbers, it's really hard to sort of tell the difference. In Yosemite there, like those routes are kind of too hard for me to free solo. So I just like took a few pieces of gear, took a little bit of rope, and was able to sort of cheat my way through the parts that are a little bit too hard. So I was still going up and by myself, but just sort of anything goes type of style.
What is danger to you?
Danger is falling off and dying. Or I mean, yeah, what do you mean? Dangerous is like driving in rush hour traffic. You know, I mean, there are a lot of things that are dangerous.
Well, I guess in your perspective, that would be true. Where I want to go with this is fear and danger, because scientists have actually looked a little bit into your brain and to your responses. And would you explain this? Because they're fascinated by what that part of your brain, the amygdala, does or doesn't do when you're in a situation of fear. So that's not technically danger, but then let's talk about fear.
We'll see if I can do this justice, but okay. But basically it was for a magazine profile. Somebody wanted to look into my fear response, because people have like speculated, sort of joking, that I lacked an amygdala, that I lacked the fight or flight response, that I just don't experience fear in the same way as normal people. This guy that wanted to write this profile with me found a researcher who would, you know, do an MRI, I think an fMRI, do the actual brain scans and see what's going on. And so they put you into the imaging device, and then they show you a series of images that are supposed to stimulate arousal in different ways. And basically, my amygdala, like, never really fired throughout any of it, which I guess is unusual. To me, it made perfect sense, because I'm like, why would looking at pictures make me afraid? You know, like, why would that trigger fear in me? Because it's a picture. Like, who cares? Some of the pictures are, like, somebody pointing a gun at you or, like, a snake. And then some of them are, like, beautiful mountain scenes and things that are designed to sort of pacify you. But to me, they're all just pictures. I'm like, whatever. You know, had they actually, like, put a poisonous snake into the tube with me, you know, I probably would have.
What is your fear reaction? What do you know about your own fear?
Well, I mean, so I do definitely experience fear, and I've definitely been in a lot of fear in my life, because, I mean, you don't, like, do this kind of free soloing on and off for 10 years without experiencing a lot of fear. Like, I've broken a lot of holds, I've had bugs bite me, like, random things going on, just, like, unexpected things. And, or even the deep dread of thinking that you're off route, which is actually, like, one of the scariest things in climbing, when you start to, you think you're climbing one route, but then suddenly you're not totally sure if you are on that route, and then you don't really know what you're doing, and then you just, like, hope that you're not questing up some virgin wall with, like, no information. I mean, things like that are actually, like, quite scary. And so I've experienced tons and tons of fear. And I kind of think that's why the imaging sort of showed my amygdala not firing for pictures like that, is because I feel like I've sort of desensitized myself to things that aren't true danger. You know, like, if I'm not actually at risk of death, then it's like, well, what is there to be afraid of?
Do any of your life adventures contain some of those more ordinary landmarks? Like, do you think about getting married someday, having a family, not spending your life on the walls in Yosemite?
I mean, I do think about, you know, having a home someday and having family and all those kinds of things. So they're sort of vague and nebulous concepts sort of out in the distant future. For now, most of my adventures just stem on the next climbing trip and where I'm going over the next year, and climbing goals and how to maintain fitness in different ways, things like that.
Why don't you mention something about what you're doing with your foundation?
So the foundation basically just been my approach to do something positive in the world, you know, because I've been quite fortunate in that I get to do what I love to do and make a decent living at it and everything. And so the foundation was just my attempt at giving grants to other environmental nonprofits. Now we've sort of started supporting our own projects, specifically in Angola last year, sort of a combination climbing trip and a solar project in Angola. Before that, we did something on the Navajo Reservation in northern Arizona. But basically, it's just an attempt to do something positive, which has mostly been focused on renewable energy and like light, providing solar-powered lights and everything.
I don't know if there are any misconceptions or any piece of information that you want people to know that I haven't asked about, but I will just open it up to you, because there are certain questions you get asked over and over, and maybe there are certain things you want to say that you aren't often prompted to.
I will say, I mean, since we're talking about the foundation a little bit, maybe one of the things that I'm most fortunate with in climbing is that it's allowed me to travel all over the world, which is like really opened my eyes to how the rest of the world lives. And I mean, that's part of why I started the foundation. And I think the more you travel, I mean, I'm spending probably half my year overseas. And it really like reminds you that you're part of a global community and that like people all over the world have the same sort of like hopes and dreams and like want to like lead good lives. I don't know. It's like really easy when you live in one little community to get sort of like myopic, you know, get sucked into that and just think about that area. But because I'm traveling so much, it's like, well, you just sort of realize that like the whole world is sort of in the same ship, you know.
Rock climbing superstar Alex Honnold talking with me in 2016. Watch for the annual body issue of ESPN magazine. It's bound to become a classic for one reason. This will be the final print issue of this magazine as it moves to digital only. The second reason, Alex Honnold is one of the featured athletes. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Insight is produced by Kate Gonzalez and Cody Drabble. Our digital team is Chris Hagan, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. We had help from Helen Barrington and Antonio Munez. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us.